Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When the rain is blowing in your face.
Hello and welcome to The Life of a Song, a monthly music podcast from the FT. In each episode, we explore the biography of a different song, its origins and the different cover versions that it's undergone. I'm David Cheel. I edit the Life of a Song series in print. It appears in the Weekend FT and online every week. This month, I'm joined by Helen Brown.
Hello.
Helen writes about pop for the FT and others. And in this episode, we'll be discussing the song Make You Feel My Love, which Helen has written about. And also, just to say, you can read previous pieces by Helen and others in a new book, The Life of a Song, which is a compilation of 50 of the columns spanning all kinds of genres and centuries of time.
And there is no one there to dry your tears. I could hold you for a million years.
So, Helen, we're talking about the Bob Dylan song, Make You Feel My Love. Tell me about the interesting stuff about the recording sessions, about the album that it came from, Time Out of Mind.
Well, they came out of some really troubled recording sessions. Some people say Bob Dylan was in a bit of a funk before he came up with the songs for Time Out of Mind. He got divorced from his second wife. A tour manager says that during this period, he was also coming off of drugs and alcohol. And while he was sober, while he was sobering up, he became quite introverted. He was struggling for new material. Then he got snowed in at his Minnesota farm, and that's where suddenly all these songs started flowing. But he seemed to need some kind of conflict to draw them out of him. So he went to a producer called Daniel Lanois, who he'd worked with in the 80s on his album Oh Mercy. And those have been really difficult sessions. Both men have big egos, big visions. Daniel Lanois is the guy who made those huge atmospheric soundscapes for U2, Peter Gabriel. Yeah, he had a strong vision of what he wanted. So did Bob Dylan. They really rowed during the making of Oh Mercy. And when Dylan wanted to be pulled out of his funk in 1997, it was Lanois that he went to again.
I was just rereading Dylan's masterful autobiographical book, Chronicles, and he writes there a lot about Oh Mercy. And they have a strange relationship, don't they? Because there was talk in the book of Lanois smashing guitars. And at one point, Dylan just goes off on a motorbike trip.
Yeah.
during the recording of the album.
Dylan says he never did mind Lanois smashing guitars so long as it wasn't one of his.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, they both had these very strong visions. And it was interesting that Lanois is famous for creating these really haunting soundscapes where instruments often don't sound like themselves. They're layered, they're textured. Mm. Whereas Dylan went into making Time Out of Mind wanting to produce something very vintage sounding, very Buddy Holly, raw, live. That's what he wanted. So Lanois was a really unusual choice to go to for that. And yeah, things got very intense in the recording studio. Bob Dylan brought in his musicians. Lanois brought in his own. Bob Dylan got everything set up with Lanois in California. The engineer set up everything in this beautiful studio. He'd fine-tuned everything. And then Dylan suddenly said, you know, I can't work here. We all need to go to Miami. Right. Now, they've got all this vintage equipment that they're not going to be able to have access to in Miami. So the poor engineer has to load up a van, drive from California to Miami. Then Dylan arrives. They get a sound that Lanois likes, and Dylan refuses to reproduce this sound. Bob Dylan has the idea of never playing the same song twice. So as soon as he hits this perfect noise that Lanois thrilled with, Dylan will tease Lanois by never reproducing it again. They never hear that sound again. So they would end up with 12 musicians in the studio, an organist with a gammy leg who kept falling over, these broken guitars. But yeah, out of this chaos, Lanois did manage to produce something that does sound very spare and stripped down.
The storms are raging on the road.
So Helen, that's kind of, it's a beautiful song, but it's quite untypical of the rest of the album, isn't it? It stands out, and quite a few critics really dismissed it at the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a dark album. It's an album which saw Dylan, who's 56 at the time, confronting mortality. He got very annoyed when people said he was confronting his own mortality. He likes to point out that actually it was everybody's mortality he was addressing.
It's got that track on it called Not Dark Yet, which is terribly, I mean, it's just bleak, isn't it?
It's, yeah, I mean, you know, it starts off with the track Love Sick. I mean, it's a grim album, and then suddenly, at track 9, after all this, you know, I've had enough of love, everything's miserable, we're on the last pages, we suddenly get the sort of like the sun breaks through the clouds, and he does this very simple, some people would say saccharine, love song of pure devotion.
And as I said, some of the critics were not impressed by it.
Not at all. They talk about greeting card sentimentality. And I can hear both of those things. There are times when the song annoys me too. It's sort of, you know, after the complexity, it's a bit irksome. It can be cloying. And then other times it just, the simplicity of it, the hymnal quality of it, the repetition of it will just catch me off guard and there'll be tears.
Yeah. And there's something a little bit unusual about the key that this song was written in, Helen.
That's right. Well, it's an unusual choice of key signature for Dylan. It's in C sharp with a capo on the first fret, if anyone's trying to play it. And what Dylan does when he's writing a song, people say he types out the lyrics first, and then he meditates. And rather than meditating on numbers or images, Dylan will meditate on an old folk or blues song, and he'll play that over and over until it morphs into something new and original that works with his lyrics.
Okay.
And the fact that this song is in C sharp suggests to me that he'd shifted key signatures quite a few times to find the right sound. So it sounds to me, there's something of the kind of well-worn pebble about this song. It sounds like he's chased it through a few key signatures to get it where he wanted it.
And some other people picked up on it pretty quickly. Billy Joel actually released a single of it before Bob Dylan's single came out. Is that right?
Yes. He did the single, and then Gram Parsons jumped on it. I mean, these were songwriters who could hear the single potential, I think, before anybody else did.
So shall we have a listen to Billy Joel's version now?
I know you haven't made your mind up yet, but I would never do you wrong. I've known
so, Billy Joel does actually tweak the tune a little bit there, doesn't he?
He does, and I do actually really like the drums that he brings in, you know, that sort of beat to it.
Yeah, and then not long afterwards, I forget the year, Brian Ferry had a go, and Brian Ferry has a long, long history with Bob Dylan covers, doesn't he, going back to Hard Rain on his These Foolish Things album. He also did a whole album of Dylan covers,
right,
called Dylan-esque. But anyway, he had a go at it with what I think is a rather lovely version.
I would go hungry, I'd go black and blue, I'd go crawling down the avenue. There's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love.
So it seems to me, Helen, that Brian Ferry there is almost channeling a kind of Daniel Lanois quality in the song, that sort of mysterious, swampy sort of feel.
Yeah, that haunted, ethereal sound. And yet, I think the interesting thing about Ferry is that he, maybe because of the context of Ferry as we know him, he seems to make it purely a romantic song. It's that sort of hungover morning after regret, nostalgia for lost romantic love. Whereas the Dylan's, I think, is more equivocal. Dylan obviously has sung a lot about spirituality, and I think the Dylan version can be interpreted both as a romantic love song and as a Christian song, or Judeo-Christian, however he defines himself at the time. And I think it's really interesting, like, for the rest of the album Time Out of Mind, Dylan is sort of on the move. He's a guy battling, you know, he's always traveling, he's always moving onwards, and then suddenly when it comes to Make You Feel My Love, he's the still place. He's offering somebody else safe harbour, a still place, and that could almost be, you know, sort of the embrace of spirituality. And it's sort of what he spoke about in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, where he's talking a lot about how his songs have always been in the tradition of Moby Dick and the Odyssey. He's always sung about a one lone traveller. But then he ends up poignantly in his Nobel Prize speech talking about the image of Ishmael, the hero of Moby Dick, clinging to a coffin in the sea. And there's something about that final still space that I think exists in his interpretation of the song that I don't think you hear in most of the other interpretations.
Do we know anything about his personal life at the time? He was no longer married, is that right?
He was no longer married. He was sobering up. Some people say he was sobering up. That's according to a tour manager at the time. So he was definitely going through a period of introspection. And he's always happy to say that you can interpret his songs on any levels.
And curiously, in Chronicles, he's ambivalent about whether or not his songs are autobiographical, because he hates people reading stuff into his songs, and yet at the same time he says actually the songs are autobiographical.
Yeah, he's the ultimate trickster songwriter, isn't he? I thought it was interesting when he had his paintings on display recently that he said, I've put these out there because what I'm seeing is what you're seeing. There can be no space for misunderstanding or misinterpretation. Yeah. You know, so he clearly wanted to fix something down at some point, but he never wants to fix anything about his songs.
So after a while, Adele comes along and and does her version of the song. I'm not sure of the order of events, whether she sang it live or recorded it. What happened first?
So I think she was played it first, and she was played it during a period of personal despair. She'd been signed. She's out in New York with her manager. She's really struggling to get her first album down. She can't get the songs out. And while she's feeling this bitter disappointment, there's a storm in New York. Her manager puts on this song. It's one of his favourites. She loves the melody, cannot work out what the man is singing, doesn't like his voice. So she Googled the lyrics, read them, thought they were absolutely beautiful. I think she thought they deserved a bit more clarity than they got from from Dylan. And it's actually went on to become her version of the Dylan song, went on to become her favourite song on her first record.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I could offer you a warm embrace to make you feel my love.
Wow, that's really beautiful. What are your thoughts on that, Helen?
Yeah, I like it. And I like the fact that something in Adele's voice relaxes in that song. And what I've noticed is in a lot of her other songs, she's asking for something. It's this, hello, should I give up? Should I keep chasing pavements? And here, she's just offering something. And it takes a little bit of tension out of her voice in quite a restful way. She allows a little bit of that growl to sneak in. There's just like the shoulders coming down.
Yeah, you're right. She sort of relaxes into it, doesn't she?
Yeah.
And it became a live favourite. I saw her earlier this year at Wembley Stadium, a memorable show, and she dedicated it to the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire, which was very moving and very beautiful and well received. She's done this before, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's dedicated it to the memory of Amy Winehouse. Her version of it is on the fundraising album Song for the Philippines. You know, she's kind of converted it into an all-purpose memorial song. It's a song of support and consolation. When she's doing that with the song, I think she's taking it out of the realm of the romantic song and turning it into, yes, a kind of group therapy.
It's a sort of arm around the shoulder song.
Yeah, it's a stadium hug.
Yes. Do you think it sort of in any way cheapens it that she's sort of dedicated it to different causes?
No, I don't. I think she pulls it off because she's sincere. I think anyone who hears the way she speaks before she starts to sing, anyone who hears her emotional connection with any of those events, I think the one thing you can say about Adele is she means what she says. And that's interestingly what Lanois wanted to bring out of Dylan. He said when he first was approached by this, you know, national treasure, he said, my job was to make him sincere. My job was to do him justice. And I think for the same reason, I think Adele is a very sincere human being.
No, it came over when I saw her at Wembley, it came over as being totally authentic and totally sincere and really moving. So how has her version been received in the wider world?
Well, it's been enormously successful. And I read recently that this is now one of the most popular songs for sort of millennials choosing tracks in at the end of karaoke sessions. And they're all channeling Adele. So it's been hugely popular. However, Dylan fans have obviously sniffed, as is their wont.
Yes.
Yeah, and when somebody confronted Adele with this, or someone said, I killed Bob Dylan with my cover, she said, I think I saved him. I think he's made about £1 million out of my cover, and I think he should buy me a watch.
Okay, on that note, thank you very much, Helen. Let's wrap it up for this month. The Life of a Song podcast will be back in November. In the meantime, you can read Helen's piece on Make You Feel My Love. Just to say also that other people have called it To Make You Feel My Love. But anyway, tiny difference. And others in the Life of a Song series at ft.com/lifeofasong. Thanks very much, Helen.
Thanks for having me.
To make you feel my love. To make you feel my love.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.